station breakdown. Pause for the message, wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows from the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
Today's show is a rerun of last week's show when we were talking with two different farmers, two different points of view. I had some requests from people that didn't get to hear it, featuring Kevin Hamilton, an organic farmer, and one of our city councillors in Hamilton, Rob Persuto, who has the largest ward in the Hamilton area. With us today in studio, we have Rob Persuto, who is the councillor for the biggest ward in the Hamilton area, and we have Kevin Hamilton, who is basically an organic farmer.
Mm-hmm.
Two different points of view on farming. What we're discussing is farming in the future. We're going to triple, as I understand, triple our capacity for inhabitants in this Hamilton area within a very short period of time. With climate change, there's going to be a real change to how we farm and what happens to the crops that we're growing now. So it's kind of a loose discussion because we have two different points of view, but it is a concern to me because I don't think we can feed Hamilton with what we've got going on now. And with the increase in water deluge and temperatures, wind, I think there's going to be a lot of big changes. You want to start us off, Rob, because we were talking a bit earlier about some of the problems with climate that you've noticed already.
Yes, Maggie, and thanks for having me out today to do the show, and with Kevin here, too. And we do have our, I think we have our differences, but we're working together on food, and it's a good thing. I have been a full-time farmer my whole life and raised seven kids on the farm, hoping one of them would come to, back to the farm and take it over. And it was a 300-acre, and it is a 300-acre cash crop farm now, but we had a hog operation, fair to finish. It was 90 sows, fair to finish. And my wife, myself, and my dad had worked on that, but I became a counselor for Ward 14, which represents a little over 36% of the total acreage of the whole city of Hamilton. So doing that, and I'm trying to bring agriculture into the limelight here in the city of Hamilton and have counselors and the people of the urban areas understand agriculture. So we're working on that. So, and I guess I can go on for hours and tell you stories about how things have changed over time and been farming for over 35 years. And we can talk about the weather and how things have changed. The weather patterns, we do see a difference in it. The amount of sunlight, the amount of rain, the temperature differences. So it's going to be an interesting time we're going to spend here today and discuss this.
Well, one of the first questions that comes up is, why did you go into politics?
I got involved in the Federation of Agriculture, which is representing farmers, and I became a director on that. It's local. So it was Hamilton Wentworth Federation of Agriculture. And got more and more involved, and then became president for a couple of years. It was 2 years. And I got more involved with the agriculture and the Federation. You deal a lot with politicians. So I'd organized rallies to Queen's Park, rallies to Ottawa, got closely working with politicians on agri issues. And from there, I also became president of pork producers for Hamilton Wentworth, once again dealing with government issues. And then I became a chairperson for the district, Niagara, Haldeman, Norfolk, Hamilton, and Brant County, and I was representing the pork producers on that too. So I worked with government quite a bit, and I through that, I gained a keener interest in knowing what I could do by talking to people and trying to work things out. And with following that through, I thought, you know, I'm going to give it a shot at this because I couldn't see any of my kids coming back farming. But I didn't do it. I didn't do this to be a counselor for the dollars. I made a lot more dollars farming, and my net income was a lot better farming full-time with the hogs out there. We were a pretty good operation, pretty efficient, but we're still cash cropping, and I think I can make a difference, and that's why I came here.
How did you think you could make a difference?
By having the city itself, we weren't getting good representation in the rural areas, and inner city here, the councilors in your city, some of them do understand agriculture, others don't. And we are one city now, and I'm hoping that through this that I can have them get a better vision of what's on the outside of the city and the need for to have agriculture. Agriculture now, the last economic impact study we've done, we had it relooked at since the census came out, and it's a $1.2 billion economic impact for the city of Hamilton. So that's quite an impact on here. And it's moving forward. Agriculture is expanding, believe it or not.
It is.
Yes.
That's surprising to hear. I'm surprised to hear that.
Well, it's in a different way. We have more greenhouses out there than ever now, and there's a lot of farming under glass.
Okay, well, let's give Kevin a chance to explain what he does out in the community. Kevin?
This winter, I'm one of the 96% of farmers, as is Rob now, that has to have an off-farm job. So I think it's 4%. The NFU was saying 4% of farmers are strictly farmers. So I was working for the Ecological Farmers Association of Ontario this past winter as the Niagara-Hamilton Outreach Consultant, and then I also sit on the board of Canadian Organic Growers. My background is political agitator, environmental activist. I'm a city boy, but I've been farming for about 7 years now.
What drove you into doing that?
Taking a look around, the job prospects, the future, feeling that there is a serious paradigm shift that will be taken over in the next 15 to 20 years, and wanting skills that are going to help me find jobs and survive in this world. So, and as an extension of my political agitation / environmental activism, I started the Walk the Walk and learn how to grow food organically to be able to feed the community, and then also I can engage with people through farmers markets and that kind of thing, be more proactive.
You have a long background of, you say, being an activist. You've also ridden a bicycle around several parts of the world, so you've got a really wide scope on how people live and farm all over the world.
Yeah, I rode in 2000 on my bicycle across Australia. I'm hanging out on farms about half the time. Across Canada once and a half in 2002-03, and then I rode my bicycle from Portugal to Vietnam, like 22,000 kilometers, visiting farms along the way, trying to figure out how the rest of the world is growing food without the aid of petrochemical fertilizers.
So you've covered how many continents?
I guess three continents and probably about 35,000 kilometers on bicycle.
And this is total grassroots. You were camping on the side of the road. You were working your way through farms. So
yep.
you saw it from a very bottom-up point of view.
Yeah, the first two rides, Canada once and a half, I went across it. And then Australia, I started nonprofit organizations, raising money, doing talks in community centers, schools, trying to get people to reduce their ecological footprint. So their overall carbon outputs and these kinds of things on an individual level, because I feel that on an individual level, we can smoke any of the numbers that the governments are trying to deal with in terms of Kyoto reduction targets for greenhouse gas emissions. Collectively, we the people can do more than the government's committed to.
I agree with that. I was just speaking to Rex Wheeler last week, original founder of Greenpeace, who says Kyoto has done absolutely nothing since it was signed in 1992, and that's pretty sad.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of scientists meeting, I think, last week in Copenhagen. And one of the problems, and I've noticed this for a few years since doing this show, is how do you word what's going on? And we're having a very major change, especially when there's money involved. And a lot of the politicians are saying to the scientists, they're trying to rework the wordage of where we sit with climate change. But climate change has to play a very big part in farming. And I'm going to go back to Rob because you recognize it. I've had some farmers in here that say, I don't see any climate change. Nothing's changed on my farm. I've been there 50 years. What have you seen change?
Well, Maggie, over the years, way back when I was younger, we used to have, you know, colder winters, more snow, and we'd always have that January thaw, and it was always expected to come, and it came. Summers, we would have rain when we needed it through the summers. Rain would come, and it'd be a warm rain. We'd get the thunderstorms. Thunderstorms, it's an old saying, but it makes crops grow. It adds nitrogen to the air and makes things grow. And we always had that. And now the winters are so different. We have warmer winters. This year is a little exceptional. It's a little cooler, but it wasn't the old-fashioned winter. We had a bit more snow. Through the summers, now we get more droughts. Rain is very spotty. From within a kilometer, you can get a downpour of an inch and a half, and then over you get an eighth of an inch or even nothing. And in fact, this past summer, I was in Frilton doing an event, and I had to get back home to combine my wheat. Frilton, which is only 3 kilometers from my home, it poured and poured rain. When I got home to my driveway, it was dry, and I went into the field, and I was combining. We never had that years ago, never. And things have changed, and I see it changing more and more. And I agree, there is a change, and it's happening.
It's happening exponentially, which is the frightening part for me, because the change is so fast that we don't know how to deal with it. And as you pointed out, and I noticed last summer myself, these storms come on very heavy, very fast, very quickly. they just dump and deluge water, so you can't really work with it. It becomes like a flood of rain coming from the sky. It doesn't spread over, and then within 30 minutes, it's gone.
Yes, and what happens from that, too, you get a lot of erosion, unless you're doing more minimum or no-till or cover crops on it, hay and that. Otherwise, we're getting a lot of erosion when these things happen.
Okay, let's talk about soil for a little bit between the two of you. I know you're both very knowledgeable on soil. I have a feeling that the listening audience really doesn't understand soil. And first, I think we should explain the value of what to do with soil and then put it in the context of the weather that we have now. And maybe I'll go to Kevin first.
Yeah, you know, I thought I knew a lot about soil until I started doing more research around Soil Food Web this winter. And, I mean, really, I don't think farmers overall know enough about soil as we should. The Soil Food Web is something I was introduced to about 7 years ago, and Elaine Ingham is arguably the most knowledgeable researcher on the subject. And she came in one handful of soil, there's about 6 billion microorganisms going on there in a healthy live soil. So you've got protozoa, you got nematodes, bacteria, fungi. The mycorrhizal fungi is the one thing of particular interest, and this is the stuff that grabs carbon and wants to hold on to it for decades and keeps that in the soil. So the stuff I've been reading, which is backed by Wayne Roberts, who's a Toronto Food Policy Council, nine tons of carbon per acre in an organic system when you've got all the microorganisms and nutrients in that working together. The Rodale Institute also backs this up with 30 years of field trials where they've had conventional and organic crops side by side. And they were finding in years of severe drought or years of severe flooding that the organic yields were actually outproducing the conventional yields. But when there was an average year where you got good sun, good rainfall when you needed it, and the gains were marginal. But in the severe years, they said that the organic crops did produce better, and that was 30 years of trials.
Why?
Because there's more tilth in the soil, there's more organic matter in the soil, so it holds water in there. And in years of drought, all that organic mass and the mycorrhizal fungi in that is just holding water in place. And so things get tapped in down. And then when there's a drought in that, it's just not washed away like with the erosion because there's more tilt, there's more matter holding things together. Like when I drive down some of the concessions in Flamborough on really windy days, I can just see dirt blowing across the road because there's nothing holding that in. So
I'm sure Rob's got a different point of view.
Well, Maggie, I'm impressed with Kevin's knowledge, and he's still learning and reading, and that's great. Probably he's got a better grip on the soil structures and that than I do from the way he's describing it here. I'm just wondering, when he talks about yields compared to conventional and organic, we're not talking grain crops like corn, soybeans, wheat, barley, and oats. Are we talking like vegetable crops? Is that what we're looking at here? Because I imagine that's where he's at.
From the Rodale site, and anybody can check that out, they've been preaching and doing field trials for 30 years, but yeah, he does everything side by side. So he'll do a 17-meter space of corn with conventional corn beside it. So they're doing pretty much the gambit.
Well, Maggie, that's where I see it. We're talking plots down here. We're not talking operations where it's 200, 300, 400, 500 acres, 1,000 acres of land down here, because these little plots are managed much better. And I can tell you that from, we've had companies come out and do seed trials on our farm. We've had the chemical trials over the years on our farm, and they're always small plots, and the yields are always better because they do manage it more intensely. And so you can go by that. But I'm not so sure from some of the research I've seen about in a larger scale that I know we're producing pretty good crops because of the new hybrids we got out there, whether it be in the corn, the soybeans, or the wheat. And they adapt these plants and these genetically for drought or different types of soil, clay soils, loam, sandy. So there's a lot of research being done on producing seeds that will work towards whatever weather we have to associate with.
So are you suggesting that chemical companies probably, or I don't know what else to call them, you can probably tell me the better term for it, but they are aware of the coming change in the weather and the extremities, and they are preparing seed to deal with droughts, to deal with flood water, to deal with whatever climate change is coming?
Flood water is difficult to deal with, but heavier rains, wetter soils, drier soils, they are working on that, and I have been growing those crops they do test them and they work on different soils and different conditions. And yes, we do have corns out there that will stand up better in drought conditions than another varieties. Because we have, you have to understand, we're growing grain corn. We're not growing eating corn. So we're growing what people call cow corn, but it's grain corn, which is used for ethanol, used to make all kinds of products in the stores. And so it's a different type of corn. And within that, we have hundreds of different varieties out there and hybrids.
All right. Go back to basics a little bit. You guys are both well knowledgeable on what you're talking about with what's in the soil and how many different brands of corn there are. But to a city dweller, an urban dweller, maybe we can do a little bit of 101 for them, why it's important from both of your points of view to handle the soil the way you do. And I think you both handle the soil slightly differently, if I don't misunderstand here.
Yeah, I mean, in an organic system, there's nothing poisonous about going in the soil. The USDA has watered down a few things where they've allowed certain nitrates and this bromide to go on strawberries and stuff. But like I say, like even organic, and I'm not taking shots at conventional farmers because I know conventional farmers that are better stewards of the land than organic farmers, and vice versa. But just by putting something like fish emulsion, which is the leftover bits of fish that are pressed into high nitrogen fertilizer, they spray that on the fields, that kills soil microbiology because it's making the soil more acidic as opposed to alkaline, which is where the mycorrhizal, all the beneficial bacteria, fungi, and that grow and thrive. And the more of a balance you have in that soil, the more of that stuff is recycling nutrients. And you don't want to be feeding the plants, you want to be feeding the soil. And if the soil is fed and the soil is healthy, then the plants will be taking out of the soil what they need. So I find in the opposite manner, even with our organic farmers too that aren't addressing the soil food web, they're just feeding the plants and it's a short-term fix. And it's not looking at a long-term health of the soil and of food supply.
Rob?
I can tell you on our farm that anything that I use, any of the compounds that I use there to spray my crops, none of those containers have skull and crossbones on them, believe me. And I wouldn't use it if it had it on there. And I can't, there's some exceptions out there for some things that specifically hit certain pests, but I don't use it, and I don't want to put a fear in anybody. That's what we're using on our food products out there on our grain crops and that. So it's different. And I can understand what Kevin's saying here too. I can tell you that there's farmers out there sometimes miscalculate what they're putting on their spraying. And I have seen it where you just put a little extra on and it will hurt the plant. It'll curl up, it'll shrivel up, it'll stunt its growth. Used the correct amount and even less than was specified on the label, plants do not seem to have any difference in growth and in yield as long as there's no weeds around them, okay? And what we're doing spraying here particularly with out there is to hit target weeds and some fungi and viruses.
I have an observation, and it's just, you know, I was born on a fruit farm. I was too young when I was there to really understand what was going on. We did DDT. I probably ate it, you know. Nice warm cherry in the summer, and Mom says you can't eat that unless you wash it. Well, our idea of washing it was to wipe it on our jeans and then pop it in our mouths. But recently I have a couple of health problems that deal with chemical sensitivities. Neuromuscular problems, and I notice there's an increase in neuromuscular problems and diseases, and it has a lot to do with the food we eat and how it's grown. And I recently took a ride up to Godrich area, up through that neck of the woods, to look at the wind farms. And on the way back, they had just cleaned off the cornfields. It's all cornfields mostly out there to my eye. And it rained. And I went into such a very bad state for 2 months because of the pig manure and the chicken manure that was sprayed on those croplands was so toxic to me. Just driving through them, I was violently, violently ill. And my brother told me, oh, you know, maybe it won't be so bad because, you know, it rained. And when it gets wet, it smells like that. I don't remember farms being spread with any kind of manure that made you feel like you were about to die breathing that stuff. And I got to say, it really did affect my health.
Maggie, what you were dealing with now and probably in the older days, and we never had on our farm, was liquid manure. and liquid manure, they don't use straw or anything organic within it. So it all goes down through what we call slats in the barns and into holding tanks and stays in there. Then it gets pumped out. So that's the ammonia, and it works with the smells to create stronger smells. And we never had that. Our farm, we always were on straw. And actually, when we'd had 1,200 pigs around, we'd have people come to the farm, and they say, do you have livestock here? So that's surprising how different it is. We farm more of the old way as far as the livestock. And I can understand it now. My wife and I do, we ride motorcycle a bit in the summertime, and we travel up through there a lot because I love that country. And it gets pretty bad. I agree with you up through there. So,
yeah, I mean, I wouldn't spread anything that isn't composted for 2 years, 3 years. I mean, I've sworn affidavits on my compost that they have no GMO feed in them and that they have been segregated piles for 3 years. So they're thoroughly composted. The weed seed is killed.
So we're talking two different ways to fertilize the croplands, but what I probably experienced, I mean, it smelled like somebody was really into industrial corn, because I feel sorry for anybody that would have to have lived within 2 kilometers of these fields, because it was just violent reaction.
It could very well have been sludge as well. I mean, that is not an uncommon practice in Ontario, where I know the municipality of Hamilton has a problem with their sludge, where there is illegal hookups, so there is industrial waste also mixing in with the sludge, or the biosolids, as it's now been euphemized to. And there's heavy metals, there's mercury, there's a whole host of metals and stuff in it. And I think the Ontario Federation of Agriculture is saying it's okay to spread. NFU is saying absolutely not. They're not for sludge at all. And if you're spreading sludge, you're not allowed to grow food on that for human consumption. So it's got to be feed for animals and livestock and that kind of thing, which the animals eat and then we eat them. So it's kind of a weird thing.
That would be my next question. Even if your intention is this food is not going to be consumed, but the animal we eat that consumes this food will still make its way, the poison will still make its way through the chain.
There, sludge is being used, and I never use it on my farm. I never would use it on because of the potential of some heavy metals in it. And it's being used. Different sludges from different cities do have a different smell to it, and some are very offensive, okay? I find them more offensive than any liquid manure out there off a farm, believe me.
Yeah, hands down.
Hands down, Kevin says, and I agree with him. And some farmers want to use sludge, some don't want to use it, so it's being transported more into the more of the rural areas because of the high costs of commercial fertilizer. And if you don't have manure from a livestock operation, they do want the sludge because it, you know, increases the nutrients down there. Again, with composting, as Kevin said, you do composting, you put that back on the land, or manure on the land, you can see such a difference in the crop, the greening of the crop, the growing, the end production, the end fruit over the grain. There is a big, big difference.
So compost wins hands down, but it takes a little longer.
It takes longer. Where do you get enough compost to cover acres, especially if you want to use it conventionally out there on the land and get away from the commercial fertilizers? I mean, there's just not enough out there.
Do we have any kind of a watchdog over sludge that you know of?
Ministry of Environment gets involved in that a lot, and they watch over that.
But what if they're not getting involved? Because I've actually had calls from a family with children that are renting a farmhouse, just panicking, saying there's neurological damage. My children are being harmed by this stuff that's being sprayed. It's full of toxins. Frantic phone calls. The only answer I could give them is move, you know, don't live there.
I know the Ministry of Environment was the most severely gutted ministry under the Harris regime in Ontario here, and most of the big polluters, even, it's a voluntary system where they don't have paid officers that are going to go and inspect things, so they might be monitoring the sludge in Hamilton. There might be guys that are going down there. I mean, I can't really speak for it, but to me, it doesn't seem like there is heavy metals. We know that there's all these heavy metals and stuff in it, so I just don't see the value of spreading that on land. Like I say, it's a quick fix. It's a good nitrogen for crops. But I mean, if we're just looking at nitrogen, potassium, phosphorus, if that's the only thing we're looking at putting on the ground to grow big fruit, then we're not looking at healthy food.
How many acres do you work, Kevin?
When I was working with Plan B, we were doing about 25 acres of mixed veg. Currently, I'm doing 5 acres of mixed veg. Because I started a smaller operation on another farm, and about 45 acres of hay.
Okay, so, and Rob, you're 300 plus, right?
Right, that's 300 plus, but it's conventional farming, but it's the newer way of doing it. We're into minimum till and no-till. That's actually where you don't plow the ground over. So you have the seeder we have, it's a John Deere drill, it's called a no-till drill. You don't actually work the land. So if we harvested wheat this past year, okay, in July and August, we took off our winter wheat crop, we call it winter wheat, it's planted the year before, we harvest that. The land has been left, and I'll come back in this spring with a no-till drill. So I don't turn the land over. I just come in with the drill, put my seed in it, put my fertilizer in it, and I just go one pass over, and it's planted. So we're not disturbing the soil. And I can tell you, we've been doing this for 2 years now, and this fall, the soil's got more tilth to it. It looks more lively because we haven't been turning it over and working it too much, or you work it when it's too wet. So with the no-till, the soil's got some more life to it. And there's more earthworms, too, a lot more earthworms coming out. You can just see them on top of the ground, especially at night.
So the no-till becomes like an organic policy for larger farms. Is that a stretch to say?
More of an organic method, I would say.
Yeah.
It's, I just love when you two guys look at each other and go, well, I don't
know. What is he going to say? What am I going to say? No, I mean, yeah, that is part of the organic principles, is no-till or little-till. I mean, the more you're, like, rototilling is when there's, like, it's almost like taking a blender to the soil, and it beats up the ground, makes nice, fluffy, perfect beds. It's like a dream to plant in, but you're killing everything in there because it's such high rotation. You're killing all the microorganisms. You're chopping the worms up and all those things that you want in the soil. I mean, to me, the healthiest indicator of soil is worms.
So that's what you mean when people say work it too much. That's what you mean. You're basically rotating it to death.
Yeah, and you get a hard pan underneath, what we call a hard pan, from plowing and working it, packing down, and then the worms don't come up. And worms, and like I said, we've seen it now, worms come up and they make a lot of holes through there. You get a rain, the moisture goes down into the ground. It's just amazing to see a difference. I've seen a difference actually in our yields too, come up with the no-till drill, okay, and the minimum till. This is not organic, but it's just a way of saving the soil and preserving moisture in it.
Do you think, how many farmers out in our sort of parameter farm your methods, Rob?
Probably we're two-thirds now of the farms within the city of Hamilton, outlying areas that are into the no-till, possibly even a bit more as of this past year, I would imagine. So it's an up-and-coming thing.
So it's basically old, but it's a new thing coming back to farmers. They're beginning to realize that this is the way to go?
Yes, it's and it's cheaper. And you're using less diesel fuel. You're making less passes. Typically, you'd go out and you'd plow, probably disc or cultivate it twice, and then plant it. And sometimes you go three, depending on if the soil didn't break up good enough. Now you just make one pass, and you're off there, and you're not using a whole lot of fuel.
Hear that, farmers? You're saving money. And probably getting another crop. Now, I wanted to get into the climate change part of this topic. We're entering a kind of a climate era we have never seen before. Winds are more intense, a lot more intense. The ferocity of the storms, they come up faster, they dump more rain. How are we going to deal with that? How do you deal with that? Anybody can jump in first.
I'll let Kevin go first.
There's definite fluctuations in the climate these days. It was 2007 was the driest year on record, followed by 2008, the wettest year on record. You just don't know what you're dealing with year to year. For me, I'm not about the technological fix. I mean, we've been growing food, we've been living on this planet for years, and in the last 100 years, we've had this astronomical spike in population. So we hit a wall and then went straight up if you look at demographic charts. And to me, we have to just slow down a bit, pull back, and then start getting our soils back into balance, start getting our waterways back into balance. I'm always looking at Ontario Medical Association, the cancer rates and these kinds of things. We're really hitting a point, but for me, there's guys I know that I think to convince farmers to go more organic and use the systems, the no-till has been a really great innovation that farmers have just looked at it and saw, wow, the my yields are better, the land looks healthier, and my inputs are less. So,
how does that fit in with the difference in the new climate? Let's call it the new climate.
Well, to me, it's all about getting that soil back into balance. So the technological fixes, I don't think, are the answers. The more we get back to the basics and we can make the basics economically viable, I think, is the answer. They just had 80,000 hectares of corn fail in South Africa in the last 2 months. It was 80,000 hectares, and that was a new hybrid seed. It was Monsanto. They're going to be footing the bill for that. And so I don't think that it's always the hybrid or the technological fix is the way. When I know guys that are getting 180 bushels of corn an acre with just the manure and an old seed from the 1800s that was developed that was good for this region.
Rob, what do you have to say about that? I mean, we're going into a situation we've never dealt with before.
And I talked about hybrids, and Kevin has two that are resistant to drought and more resistant to wet weather. But when we talk severe drought, it doesn't matter what you grow, it's going to harm the crop, okay? Or severe rain or severe temperatures or higher lows. But I'm talking moderate fluctuations down here. But we're having more severe fluctuations in temperature and rainfall, and it's difficult to understand exactly, you know, what to plant where and what's going to happen in your area or your concession that's out there. It'll be raining like crazy in downtown Hamilton. I can go up the top on the way home to Claps and Cut. The sun's shining up there, and it never rained at all the way to my home, which is 32 kilometers from downtown Hamilton.
Well, what I saw last summer was one of those instant thunderstorms, and I saw 2 feet of water running down Carolyn Street. It came upon us within 5 minutes. I think I was not even a kilometer from my home, and I couldn't get there. I was drowning, literally, with the rain coming at me horizontally. That's how intense it was. I expect more of that, and I'm wondering how many farmers are thinking about that and finding ways to deal with that kind of intensity.
It's a guessing game, Maggie. You never know what you're going to get. And like I said, they're going to no-till. More have gone to no-till because they're realizing and ridge-till, they call it, too. They're realizing the differences in the weather and how the rain affects the washouts. And when you get the heavy erosion, it takes away the nutrients. It takes away the spray that's put on, the amount of spray it's put on just to do the job, not to overdo it. Or, you know, sometimes people think a little more is better, but that's not true, whether it's be baking a cake or anything else. You got to follow the recipe, and sometimes, you know, you want to make a cake and put a little less sugar in it because you don't want the sugar. Well, then it's the same with the spray. We always try to use a little less. But my fear is with these heavy rains that we're washing away a lot of the topsoil, which is vital for growing. We're washing away what we put on there for the nutrients, which does, and I'm not disagreeing, it does get into our waterways and our streams and back into our wells. So we have to be very careful and deal with that, but the weather is difficult. We cannot control Mother Nature.
Let's talk about population growth. I've heard so many stories over the last few years about how many more people will be coming to Hamilton area and how little we have in the ability to feed ourselves now.
Yeah, there's definitely, I mean, the population is absolutely exploding. Like all the charts I look at, it's kind of frightening how many more mouths we have to feed. I know in Africa, the United Nations just put out a study February the 6th that 114 projects in 24 different countries, and the average yield when using organic or near organic practices was it's 110% increase, and it was 128% in Eastern Africa. And I'm not saying that organic systems are going to outcompete conventional everywhere, but in a lot of climates they will, and a lot of climates they won't. It's about the same. But the studies I was looking at coming out of the Rodale Institute, and that was in first world nations, organic output is about 90% of the conventional yields, and in third world countries it was 82%. And to me, the biggest problem is a political problem. It's a problem of distribution. It's a problem of a global commodity trade that has, where the market has been unsaturated by a few companies, chemical companies that are buying up food production, that are buying up the fertilizers. And that's where the problem lies. It's a political problem. We're still able to grow enough food to feed the world, but there's a ton of waste.
A ton of waste.
Like food waste.
Where is it going? Where is it wasted?
It's going into landfills. It's going into, I mean, I don't know the stats off the top of my head for Ontario, but we're exporting most of our food. Like, I remember hearing 80% of our food is going out of Ontario. So, because we can get it cheaper from somewhere else. And fortunately, the consumers, that's what they're looking for. They're looking for cheap food. And we live in a country where we're spending about 15% of our incomes on food, whereas most of the world is spending around 80% of their income on foods.
I think that stat's going to change pretty rapidly.
I sure hope so.
Okay, I'm interested in going back to that. But, Rob, I wanted to find out what you think about, let's say, the political state of feeding the people of this area, feeding the people that are coming.
Well, there's no doubt the population is growing, and in which, you know, if we had jobs for them and we could get them in Hamilton, it'd be a great thing for the city of Hamilton and the surrounding area, and it would reduce the taxes for the people here. We can get jobs going and businesses paying and people working, and when people work, they're going to buy food. And we have to realize, people have to realize, you know, you just don't go to the grocery store and buy food. And in Hamilton, we're working on I'm on part of the food security committee down here, and we're talking about, you know, rooftop gardens and green roofs. And I see Maggie's quite pleased about this. And I see that side of it, too. And rooftop gardens, community gardens, all of that is a good thing. But we have to get more people involved. You're going to, and I look around, you see a select group of people that get involved in this, and the rest, everybody lives busy lives out there, and they never got time for anything. They go to work, they come home, they rush the kids to different sports, they rush the kids to music. Other ones don't have that opportunity. They're much poorer. We need to bring everybody together, and with the food security group here in Hamilton is one of the things. And it's good that people can grow a little bit of what they need in their backyard or on their deck in a planter. Doesn't sound like much, but it helps.
I'm really glad to hear you say rooftop gardens and community gardens, because that's been a pet thing for me for 5 years. I don't see any change yet, really. The only change I've seen is from the poor in the community saying, okay, we're tired of starving. We are going to grow some food. The problem that we have is the location of our country, of course. We only have a limited growing season, so we have to figure out how to deal with it. And go back 100 years, how did they deal with it then? We're dealing with weather uncertainties. Urbanization. When you were talking about the fact that people are too busy, now this may change pretty radically, and I think there's been a lot of change already. All the job layoffs, people are panicking, they don't have an income. There's going to be a sudden rush for food, and maybe that will be the catalyst that makes these people that were formerly too busy to find out want to start, I'll rip out my pool and I'll put in a garden, hopefully, or I'll join. I don't know, but there's going to be a big need for change because a lot of people are going to be hungry very soon, if not already. And so how can we take advantage of that kind of human disaster? How can we implement getting them food that will survive them the entire year?
I feel like hopefully politicians or our governments will step up to the plate, because so far they're a no-show. Farmers are really hurting in this country. 15 in the last 20 years, income's worse or the same as Great Depression. Kitchener-Waterloo, food policy people were estimating about 70,000 farmers to feed the GTA. There is an absolutely massive potential to have people back on the land, and there's a lot of really skilled immigrants that come from backgrounds or agriculturally based places in the world and countries in the world where they already have those skills and their bodies are strong because they've been down in the dirt, down in that position, weeding, harvesting for their lives, so their bodies are a lot more
okay, but we don't have the land, let's say. We are losing land fast because we're having people come in, they have to have a place to live.
Food preservation is where it comes into me. Fermentation, drying out food, processing. We need more infrastructure for all that kind of stuff.
Maggie, we talk about food, and Kevin's mentioned 70,000 farmers, I believe, to feed the GTA. And as you said, we need the land to do that. And 70,000 farmers, and I'm just trying to imagine how many farmers it take to feed it now, but We're nowhere near that kind of a number, because I'm talking conventional or larger scale farming than Kevin's talking. organic, I would believe, and
more intensive.
More intensive farming, and okay, we'll go with more intensive, which also is what we are doing conventionally too. What's happening out there? If you could take the rice stocks in the world, and they're way down. I think they're the 25 lowest level in 25 years. The inventory on rice alone, and rice feeds a large portion of the world out there. So just imagine that, and if we have another, you know, we have droughts out there, and no. Whether or not to grow this stuff, there's more demand for food. There's demand for food. You know, our grain crops, the other countries look forward for that stuff to come there. So we ship that out there. And so it puts more pressure on our own people down here. It's the same with Asia, South Africa. They're all, their incomes have gone up over the years. And they can afford to buy more meat products, more proteins. And when they do that, then we have to produce more grain, more soybeans, wheat to feed this livestock. It puts more pressure on. And then these times now we're looking at the biodiesel, we're looking ethanol, so we're growing crops for that. I don't believe that's what we should be doing. I think we've got to find alternatives for transportation. And, you know, this is all linked together. Everything is linked to food, and that's why we're here, because of, I mean, good water and good food, whether it's organic grown or conventionally grown. It's why we're here and why we live.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because I'm always saying, you know, especially when I hear plans to do with economics or, you know, any business plan everywhere I go, if you don't have an environment, if you don't have food, water, and air, all the business plans mean nothing.
Absolutely.
These global problems are global. There's bad weather all over the world. Why are we shipping grain to Africa and Asia? I don't think that's the answer. I think we have to get localized everywhere, all over the world.
That's the problem, is we've been spoiled with food from all over the world. I mean, an immigrant was once telling me the first time he walked into a Fortino's and saw the produce section, he thought it was a museum of food from different spots around the world. But like, if rice is having a shortage, then we can grow tons of grain here in Ontario that can feed our local populations. You just don't eat rice. There's a paradigm shift that's happening. Like I say, peak oil, peak population, all these things have gone for the last 100 years slowly curving up to wha-bam, they're going straight up now.
It's going to be real fast
and
now.
Yeah. We look at all those graphs, and peak soil is something that people don't talk about either, but we just need to start eating seasonally. We need to start knowing, like people are asking me for strawberries in August, you know, and it's just there's not strawberries in August. Education is a huge thing to re-educate the population, one for mm-hmm. nutrition. I mean, we're still eating white bread. Bleached white bread, like that's amazing to me, and that's being fed in the hospitals too, but there's no nutrition in that. And anytime anybody gets cancer these days, if you're going to an alternative medical practitioner, they're telling you macrobiotic, organic, whole food diet, take all that processed food off your shelves, because that's where you're going to get nutrition from. And if we're able to eat more seasonally, then we're not going to be as dependent from stuff coming around the world. And we are still going to have some kind of trade happening. There's no doubt about it. But we could reduce our ecological footprints like more than half if we have that paradigm shift, or when we have that paradigm shift, more accurately.
Maggie, I keep hearing about cancer. Kevin mentions cancer, and other people do too. And we talked about food products and more cancer. There's no definite research out there that shows, you know, that conventional food causes cancer. There's no research, you know, that says that there's an increase in cancer because of type of food we're eating. And what food, where's it coming from? You know, what part of the world, what's it used by? We've had stuff, and I'm not running anybody down here. I'm just saying what we've seen. We've had stuff come here from China with the melamine in it, okay? I mean, we got to look at all these things. We here in Canada, we do a lot to protect our food, to look after it. From the research companies, the seed companies, the companies that produce the pesticides, they spend a lot of money on research, and we, the farmers, pay for that, okay, when we're buying the product. So that's all gone through and checked. And yet we'll turn around, we'll buy a food product in from out of country that we don't know how it's been grown, what's been put on, and we got to realize this.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that, because I'm one of those people that have those sensitivities. I go to the farmer's market as often as I can, but sometimes I feel, well, there's a depletion of iron, so I need to get some spinach, and it's out of season, so I go to one of the booths that maybe get things shipped in, but at least shipped in from the North American continent, And I just had a feeling about it. And instead of eating it raw in a salad, I steamed it. It smelled like oil. I didn't eat it. I never had spinach smell like that before. And the same thing with the cherries, which were coming, I think, from Chile. I thought, oh, wonderful. They're beautiful to look at. They smelled like gasoline. Now, I smell that stuff because I'm sensitive to it. Maybe I'm one of the minorities. But this is what you're eating.
I've got a really interesting way that effective microorganisms is something that's used in pretty much the entire continent of Southeast Asia. Anybody who's farming organically is effective microorganisms is simply a blend of bacterial, fungi, protozoa, and nematodes that they will do foliar sprays or they'll just water straight in. So then these microorganisms get into the soil. They chew things up and make nutrients readily available for plants. But in order to see if these microorganisms are working properly in the soil, they will take a pepper or whatever they're growing and just sit it on the table and let it rot. And they'll smell this kind of sweet, kind of pungent, like when if anybody does any fermentation, making a grapes, wine, cheese, whatever. Like there's a certain smell that it's not an offensive smell. Now, if you take a conventional vegetable and you let that rot, there's a definite difference in the smell when things are rotting, and to me that's just like a simple thing that that people in Southeast Asia were doing to see how effective the microorganisms are working. And I've smelled it too, and it's there is a difference.
You were talking about drying food. That's interesting.
Well, I mean, for preserving, so like our peaches and all these kinds of things, so are dehydrating. So then we have things in a stable form. Like Captain Cook and those guys came over, I think it was 27 months they sailed, and they were doing that, avoiding scurvy, by having barrels of sauerkraut that lasted 26 months. Now, I'm fermenting sour Reuben is basically like any root vegetable that you ferment, and it's cover is basically salt, water, brine, submerged for a couple of weeks, and then that there's a transformation that happens, and the enzymes and everything else in that food is live stuff, the stuff that you need in your stomach, breaking down food, the same thing that's in the soil. These are the same things that fermented foods do for your body and the nutrition, and they convert things from, say, that's something that's high in vitamin C to a bunch of different complex B vitamins. So, I mean, nutrition is... I think that's really a key, too, because then we have to eat less, too. The more nutrition our body gets, the less we need. And I think that's why there's the obesity problems with all the processed foods that are nutritionally void, pretty much.
Okay, so this is a combination of ideas that have to change.
Well, Maggie, you know, in older days, I'm not that old, but older, I remember my mother, she used to do all the canning and preserving and put the borscht away in jars and the sauerkraut. We made all that and canned it, local peaches and local pears. And that's things that we got to get back to, okay? We got to get back to that. And that's where people can eat locally year-round, okay? They can preserve a lot of this stuff and freeze it. And can we bring that back? I don't know. History always seems to repeat itself in some sort of way. And I think that's where we're looking at organic regeneration here. That's the way we used to do things years ago, and it's coming back. There's no doubt. But we have to understand we're feeding a large population out there. It's a world population. We as farmers, whether anywhere in Canada here, are growing grains, and then we have to have a place to sell them. So we sell them to the large conglomerates who have storage and who have the deals with the world agencies out there to move grain, and that's their job to do that. So that's how that grain gets shipped out of the country. And that has to be done for farmers to live. Farmers do, conventional farmers and the larger ones, big operations, they do hire a lot of employees, they buy a lot of equipment, and it's part of keeping the economy going.
Okay, so you're saying, as the situation stands right now, you need a farmer like yourself, you need a middleman, you need to grow larger crops, and you have to have it shipped out. What about, I mean, is it likely that a lot of the farmers that are still working in that kind of environment right now, if there's a sudden paradigm shift, what about bringing things back to a local position? What about bringing it back so it's not traveling so far? Is that possible? Is that doable? Are farmers thinking about that?
Maggie, we're talking, when we grow grains, we're talking hundreds of thousands and thousands of tons of grain. How do you utilize it within the city down here? And we have to get a decent price for this stuff for us to survive. There's no doubt our fertilizer prices in the past year, commercial fertilizers, tripled. And every time the stock market, the grains go up in Chicago a little bit, the fertilizer just jumps. And then when the markets come down the next day a bit, the fertilizer doesn't come down that much.
Economic vultures.
Well, it's true, because there's less and less out there. Every time a company, you know, company gets a good business going, the bigger guy comes along and just bites them and takes them over.
Puts them out. And
so can we change that? I think we're going to have to change that. We're going to have to make a major change. We won't be able to continue living in a global world, as we've just seen. It's a global crash. And this is the wall that a lot of people are coming up against, because it's a major mind shift to go back 50, 60 years of the way of doing things.
We just have to keep educating people. We need more, you know, in the press out there, in the radio, like today, and the TV and the newspapers, the magazines. And I understand a lot of people don't read it, but, you know, people talk, and we could relay the message.
Yeah, I think we just really, I mean, the companies that are doing the fertilizers and the chemicals and the veterinary drugs and the Sobeys and the food distributors and the food processors and all that, they're making, in 2004, they're making record profits, up to the second, third, fourth highest profits they've ever made. They're profiteering on the backs of the farmers in a for-profit food system that is not benefiting anybody but corporations, pretty much. And like I say, the farm income levels are super low, and we need to look at low input ways of getting good yields that are sustainable economically, that are sustainable for our environment, that's going to have healthier air, healthier water, healthier soils, healthier people. And this is the triple bottom line approach that we have to look at. Economics, the GDP, is a demented way in an antiquated system of looking at the well-being of our society. You have to look at that triple bottom approach, the bottom line, the social impacts, the environmental impacts, and the economic impacts. And our government is so far looking down a long road of money, and that is a huge problem. And until we can get that for-profit system figured out and start treating food as a common, that's going to be a problem. I mean, that's a huge, you know, maybe delusion of grandeur, but we need to get the politicians and we need to get the people that actually care into office doing these things.
Well, from what I hear on this show, and because I look purposefully at alternative news, I hear that a lot, that we're at a point right now where we can't continue to grow because we've overshot our carrying capacity, and we're in a real problem. So once again, we're back to a major paradigm shift. I've heard all my life how farmers have not made a profit. I've seen all my life how the farms, the smaller farms like Kevin's and from where I was, turned into surveys and suburbs, and then the food is shipped in from someplace else on a truck, which causes more pollution and causes more. I mean, it's a spin-off industry, but is it the right industry? And now we're hearing about all these, you know, food as a commodity, which should never be a commodity. And a handful of people making all kinds of money, and most people being laid off, and all these worldwide deficits happening. So, Rob, I have to give you a chance to talk to what Kevin was saying and I'm saying. Let's see if we can say something rather intelligent and hopeful to the listeners.
Well, Maggie, and you talked about, you know, we're using up land to put houses on, good farmland, and any land, whether it's class 1, 2, or 3, which is good land and poor land, it's all capable of producing food out there if you know how to manage it right. And I hate to see more and more land going into homes in Hamilton down here. Why can't we, you know, do better planning in downtown and revitalize the downtown and put the housing down there and bring the people there? And that way they will keep the core of the city going. They'll buy in there. We can have the local market. We do have the farmers markets there. It's great. And, you know, I see both sides, whether it be organic or conventional. I see both sides. There's a need for it. We have to supply food, okay? And I like the idea of the local and the organic. I like the idea of the conventional coming in here and being able to sell at our markets. And we have to agree to work together on this. I mean, we both got our differences, but we both see the need to supply good local food to the people of Hamilton and the surrounding areas.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I'm, from my perspective and in my travels and all that, I really deeply feel that we need to look at deep ecology, and we need to look at getting our soil structures back, getting things, feeding the soil, not the plants. And I think the sooner we can get conventional farmers transitioning, and it's already starting, to do more organic methods, the better we're going to sit. And I mean, I just look at the Ontario Medical Association. When I was born in 76, one in six people had cancer. Then it went one in five, one in four, one in three, one in two now. The last year's studies were one in two people get cancer, one in three people die of it in their lifetime. And that is from the food that we eat. That is from the latex paints, the retardant stuff on pillows that kill. And the Italian studies is the most in-depth study that I've said, where they did urinalysis on school-age children for 2 weeks, feeding them normal food with mom, pa, put them on a strict organic diet, and they saw the metabolites and toxins eliminated from their urine in 1.5 to 2 days. And that really says something to me. And I'm not blaming food for cancer, but it is one of those things. We're breathing, we're eating every day.
Let's not call it food is causing the cancer, but what the food was grown in or what's on the food that may be causing the cancer, okay? So just so we don't, you know.
Meg, it could be the air. It could be the air.
It could be. Well, in Hamilton, you know, we get more pollution here from the States than we get from Hamilton. And we get a bad rap for that.
It's a bioaccumulation of everything. And I'm just saying that our ecosystems can't take much more of the chemicals that we've been putting on them.
That's
for the
true.
Last 60 years.
I have to agree with that. We have to stop doing things the way we have been doing things, because we've discovered quite rudely they don't seem to be working too well right now, and things are going to get worse. It's going to be a mode of survival for the next 10, 20 years, I'm thinking. A big change, mode of survival. You can't do things the way you've always done things, and there's an awful lot of opposition to that, but I don't see any other choices.
Nope,
I really don't.
It's going to be an interesting time coming forth, so...
You guys are both lucky that you're in touch with the earth and you have food. Who knows, maybe people will be flocking to your farms. You'll get free labor just so they can eat. That would be helpful. We've been speaking with Rob Bersuda. Robert Bersuda, who is, what is it, Ward 14?
Ward 14 represents 36% of the land area of the city of Hamilton.
Largest ward in the city of Hamilton area, the greater GTA. And Kevin Hamilton, an organic farmer who has been very instrumental in changing local small farms over to an organic format. And he's doing them one by one, aren't you, Kevin?
I'm trying to.
I thank you both so much for coming in this afternoon and giving us a little bit of information. Maybe we'll wake a few heads up.
Maggie, it's been a pleasure with you and Kevin.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Bye.
Dusty old farmer, out working your field, hanging down over your tractor wheel. The sun beating down, turned the red paint to orange. Rusty old patches of steel. There's no farmer songs on that car radio, just cowboys, truck drivers, and pain. Well, this is my way to say thanks for the meal, and I hope there's no shortage of rain. Straw hat and old dirty hankies, mopping a face like a shoe. Thanks for the meal, here's a song that is real, from a kid from the city to you. Straw hat and old dirty hankies, mopping a face like a shoe. Thanks for the meal, here's a song that is real, from a kid from the city to you. Combines gang up, take most of the bread. Things just ain't like they used to be. Though your kids are out after the American dream, and they're working in big factories. If I come by when you're out in the sun, can I wave at you just like a friend? These days when everyone's taking so much, there's somebody giving back in.
This has been The Other Side of the News. I am your host, Maggie Hughes. Thanks for listening.
An old dirty hankies, mopping a face like a shoe. Thanks for the meal, here's a song that is real, from a kid from the city to you. Straw hat and old dirty hankies, mopping the face like a shoe. Thanks for the meal, here's a song that is real, from a kid from the city to you.
Fine. Radio.
See you.